Thank you for listening to this podcast from TRE, Talk Radio Europe, your voice in Spain and around the world. For more information, please visit tre.radio.
The TRE Book Show is sponsored by Audible. Click on the Audible banner on the talkradioeurope.com homepage to download your free audiobook today. Terms and conditions apply.
The Book Programme. Presented by Hannah Murray.
Good evening. Welcome to tonight's book show. My first guest is Jodie Ginsberg, who is the CEO of Index on Censorship. It is Banned Books Week in the UK. It's a nationwide campaign that celebrates radical and rebellious readers and the freedom to read, write and think. Their aim is to inspire people of all ages and backgrounds to celebrate the freedom to read, while at the same time educating and informing about key issues relating to book censorship. Also with us is Emma Kennedy, who was the winner of Celebrity MasterChef in 2012. She's the author of 9 books, including The Tent, The Bucket and Me. She's also an actress and has appeared in many award-winning comedies like Goodness Gracious Me and Miranda. Her latest novel, The Things We Left Unsaid, is a life-affirming read which explores the ways in which it is the people we love the most who truly shape us. On tonight's book show is Robert Lyons, whose debut novel The Shell Collector is based on his extensive research and his own knowledge of the City of London during the 70s. It's about Guy Magnus, who places a bet with his friend and rival stockbroker Harry Griffin that he will be the first to show £1 million. It is partly based on a true story. Finally on tonight's book show is Susan Edmonds, a business journalist by day and a fiction author by night. She lives in New Zealand and most of her non-work writing relates to motherhood and the crazy experience of being left to take care of a child when you have no real idea what you're doing. Her latest novel, Mummy Needs a Break, is a hilarious story of the ups and downs of unexpected single motherhood. That's all on tonight's book show on Talk Radio Europe.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray. The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line now from the UK is Jodie Ginsberg, the CEO of Index on Censorship. This is to do with the fact that this week is Banned Books Week. It's a nationwide campaign that celebrates radical and rebellious readers and the freedom to read, write and think. Its aim is to inspire people of all ages and backgrounds to celebrate the freedom to read, while at the same time educating and informing about key issues relating to book censorship. Welcome to the book show, Jodie.
Thank you for having me.
A pleasure. Thanks very much for joining us. So how long has Banned Books Week been happening for?
Well, Banned Books Week was launched in 1982 and it started in the United States. It came in response to a sudden surge in the number of challenges to books that were being seen in schools, bookstores and libraries. In other words, not necessarily the kind of censorship we might normally expect from government saying this book cannot be published, but for example, school boards or parents saying, we don't want that book to be taught to our children, or we don't want that book to be available in libraries. And so teachers, librarians, academics come together every year to celebrate books in all of their forms and, as you say, the freedom to read. And for the last couple of years, we've been doing something similar in the United Kingdom, encouraging people to think about the value of reading, the value of writing, and whose voices are being heard or whose voices are being silenced.
That's an interesting one, because I'm not aware of books being censored or censorship happening in the UK for a long time now. Am I right in thinking that?
There's been no official censorship in the UK for several decades, so we no longer have a Lord Chamberlain who decides what plays can be put on or what books can be put out. You will remember perhaps the infamous case of Lady Chatterley's Lover, which really overturned that kind of censorship in the UK and essentially said, well, that kind of book can be made available. So we don't have that kind of state censorship. There are a number of different ways in which voices and authors can be silenced. So in recent years, we've seen a lot of pressure, for example, from social media deciding that certain kinds of authors, perhaps because of their political views or their religious views, are not acceptable, and putting pressure on publishers or indeed the individual themselves not to publish certain material.
And does that kind of thing work these days? I mean, there's a part of me that thinks that if books are talked about in that way, that will make people want to get hold of them more.
Well, yes, so indeed, talking about a book as being unacceptable can make it more popular. It's interesting that in the United States, for example, each year the Libraries Association brings together a list of the books that have been most often challenged. And it's interesting that a lot of these relate to young people, LGBT issues, for example. One of the most challenged from last year's was The Hate U Give by Angie Thomas, which was referred to as kind of anti-cop and blasphemous and including profanity and drug use and so on. And I think that kind of thing does indeed make people want to read it more. The problem is in the other case where you're finding that authors, for example, are being or publishers are having pressure put on them because of the political leanings of their authors, that those books don't get published at all. So we have seen cases where, for example, young adult authors have book pressure put on them even before publication, so their books don't come out at all.
Interesting. And the fact that the UK now doesn't have an official censorship, as you said, does that make authors too, or even publishers too, complacent, do you think? And, you know, that sometimes too much freedom or freedom can be too much for some.
I don't think it's the lack of an official censor that necessarily makes publishers complacent. I think one of the challenges about when we talk about the kinds of voices is that often the censoring of voices or the silence of voicing doesn't necessarily come from the state, as we've heard. And one of the challenges I think that publishers now have is trying to find different voices. So diversity, for example, in the publishing industry continues to be poor, and that means that we have very few BAME authors, for example, being published as writers of children's books, and therefore you have far fewer characters who are from diverse backgrounds. And I think those are the kinds of challenges now for publishers and writers.
Yeah, there's various things happening this week to coincide with Banned Books Week. One of the things is Margaret Atwood's highly anticipated book, The Testaments, which is the sequel to The Handmaid's Tale, will be released. And I know she's doing some talks. I know she's behind the Banned Books Week.
So Margaret Atwood, we're very fortunate to have as an Index on Censorship patron. She's actually just released The Testament. So that came out just before Banned Books Week and into, if you like, quite a lot of bookshops in the UK, had midnight parties to celebrate the launch of that book and to showcase Banned Books Week coming up. A number of people are having events across the country, and we've got libraries having banned books displays, so encourage people to go into their local library or their local bookshop and check out displays. We've got bookshops from the north of Scotland to the very tip of England taking part. So there should be some exciting and different displays encouraging people to read perhaps something they haven't tried before.
Yeah, brilliant. And what does Index on Censorship do particularly?
Index on Censorship is a freedom of expression organisation. So we ourselves publish work by censored writers and artists. We have a quarterly magazine that features their work. And we've published the likes of Nadine Gordimer, Salman Rushdie, Margaret Atwood. We've had a recent interview with Margaret Atwood. And then we also campaign on free expression issues to ensure that everybody has the right and the ability to speak freely.
Great stuff. Well, if people want more information on Index on Censorship, there's a website which is indexoncensorship.org. And for more information on Banned Book Week, again, that has a website, bannedbooksweek.org.uk. We've been speaking to Jody Ginsberg, the CEO of Index on Censorship. Jody, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks very much.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line now from the UK is Emma Kennedy, possibly best known as the winner of Celebrity MasterChef in 2012. She's also the author of 9 books, including The Tent, The Bucket and Me, and Shoes for Anthony. She's a regular writer for children's TV shows on CBBC, which include Strange Hill High and Danger Mouse. She's also an actress and has appeared in many award-winning comedies, including Goodness Gracious Me, People Like Us and Miranda. She's with us on the book show to talk about her latest novel. It's called The Things We Left Unsaid. Welcome to the book show, Emma.
Hello, thank you for having me.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thanks for joining us. And you sound like a very busy person.
I am beset with busyness, yes. that's how I like it to be. I can't bear to be sitting still for a minute.
Yeah. And is it nice to be able to do so many different things as well, such a variety?
Yes, I find that I'm at my most productive, actually, when I've got more than one thing on the go. I need that impetus to be creative, I think.
Yeah. And tell us about, before we talk about the books and the latest book, tell us about the acting, being on shows like Miranda. That must be so much fun.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, I've always maintained that the acting is the most pointless profession for a grown-up, because it's literally just mucking about. I don't tend to do it so much now. I only do it now if it's something I really want to do. Simply because it's so time consuming, and my first passion is writing, but yeah, my goodness, I've done some great things, some really fun things to do.
Yeah, can you give us an example?
I think the most overwhelming experience I ever had was being in a film with Cate Blanchett and Dame Judi Dench. That was quite something. I mean, I never ever in a million years thought I would be in anything with the great Dame Judi, but that was a fantastic experience. But I mean, it was the thing that I used to do a show on BBC Two that was called This Morning with Richard Not Judy, and I had only just recently stopped being a lawyer, and I used to play, and you might not know the show, but it was a very culty comedy show that went out live on BBC Two on Saturday mornings, and it was an absolute riot. And there was one point where I played a character called Nostradamus, who was a Welsh woman pretending to be the 16th century mystic in order to try and win a barbecue. It was quite complicated. I had a false horse who was called David Collins, and there was this one moment when I was standing on set and I had horse's legs. I was wearing horse's legs. I had a fake man's chest with a tattoo of Robbie Williams on it. I had a grey beard. I had enormous grey eyebrows. I was wearing a top hat, and I had on one arm a puppet of the alien from Alien. And I just thought, yeah, this is what I want to do.
I've truly made it.
Yeah.
Fantastic. And with all the writing that you do, you've written a selection of memoirs, also writing for children's TV shows, as I mentioned, and various fictional books for children and crime and women's fiction as well. Is there one writing medium that you enjoy more than others, would you say?
I really like writing animation. That's brilliant fun. And it, you know, your imagination can run absolute wild with that, especially the stuff I did on Danger Mouse. It's amazing the stuff that you can put in a script and then it will happen. But I think that the book I probably enjoyed writing the most was, it was probably one of the Wilma Tenderfoot books, actually. I loved writing that series. I think I just have an affinity with the sense of humour that children have, and it's not childish. It's about possibilities. It's about imagining things that can't possibly happen, and you can make them happen. And I was a great fan of the Roald Dahl books when I was growing up as a child, and I always was rather in awe of how brutal he was and how he would quite regularly kill people's parents off on page one in order to sort of plunge a child into danger and peril. And the thing that you understand when you meet children is that they love that. They really love reading books about other children who are in terrible, terrible trouble. And it's not because they enjoy the pain that character is going through. It weirdly makes them feel safe that they are not in the same position.
Yeah, that makes sense.
It's quite interesting.
Interesting. Interesting. Yeah. Yes, I was a huge Roald Dahl fan as well, so I know exactly what you mean.
Yeah.
And your experience on Celebrity MasterChef, that must have been quite epic as well.
It was the single hardest thing I think I've ever done.
Really?
Yeah, no doubt. But it was harder than finals. It was. I'll never forget the first day. I had signed up to it because MasterChef was honestly my favourite program.
Hmm.
And I'd always wanted to do a cookery course. And I thought, oh, brilliant, when I was asked to do it. I thought, brilliant, brilliant. I'll be in it for a week. I've just finished writing one book. I'm about to start writing another one. I can have a week off. I'll go and do MasterChef. I'll be out first round. It'll be fine. But it'll be like doing a lovely cookery course. How wrong was I? So day one, I will never forget this. I turned up and we were put into what we called the Room of Depression. And you know, that sort of that penned area where you always see the contestants sitting looking miserable on the sofas.
Yeah.
And we hadn't met Greg or John, and we were just sitting, and we sat there for a good long while, and then someone came in and said, oh, can you all just line up against the wall? And we lined up against the wall, and we thought, oh, they're just getting the lineup shot and everything. And then they said, right, just walk through to the studio, because we hadn't even seen the studio yet. And we walked in, and John and Greg were standing down one end. There were cameras lined up everywhere. We all stood behind a bench, and John said, hello, welcome to MasterChef. In front of you is a box. You've got 50 minutes, go.
My goodness, no preparation at all.
Absolutely nothing. You never knew what you were doing on any given day. They tell you nothing. You don't even know where the salt and pepper is.
But and you won it.
I did win it. I did win it. I think the thing about me is that when I turn my mind to something. I want to do it properly. And that first day was so utterly terrifying that, because you just feel completely out of control. And I think this is the interesting thing about MasterChef, is that all of us, whoever goes and does it, whether it's the normal one or whatever, you are competent in the profession that you have chosen to be in. You know what you're doing, but you are suddenly plunged into a world where you haven't got the first clue what you are doing. And it's, I don't know if you're like me, but, you know, I can't go anywhere unless I'm prepared. I just can't. Yeah. It literally brings me out in hives. It's that feeling of turning up for an exam you've forgotten to revise for. It's that. And I can't do it. So I just knuckled down and taught myself to cook.
That's fantastic. And what was the thing that you were most proud of that you made that you thought, yeah, I did all right here?
There was a particularly fine phyllo pastry raspberry meringue pie that I made that was very, very, very pretty. I did a very good twill biscuit, a shaped twill biscuit that I was slightly astonished that I'd made. And I think one of my favourite dishes was I did a roasted turbot in a clam broth with a lovely fennel and coriander salad on top of it, and that went down very well.
Oh, fabulous! And do you do that sort of cooking at home now, or was it a kind of one-off, completely out of your comfort zone moment?
I was a very plain. Slam a protein in the oven and steam some vegetables type of cook. And now I think absolutely nothing of catering for people. I remember that after the day I'd won it, obviously I couldn't tell anyone I'd won. And I went to stay with Emma Freud. And she said, do you fancy cooking tomorrow? And I said, of course I will. Okay. She knew I'd got to the final, but she didn't know if I'd won. And I said, of course I'll cook, thinking it would be, you know, about six people. And I said, how many people? And she said, 50. And I didn't bat an eyelid.
Wow, that's impressive.
That is the gift of MasterChef. The gift of MasterChef is you have zero fear about food and preparing it, and, you know, for any amount of people. It's incredible. But you do have to do it yourself. You don't get any training whatsoever, apart from when you go to the professional kitchens.
Yeah.
You will be, you know, you're told what you're doing there by those chefs, and you're told and you're taught how techniques that you have to employ to do the dish that you are required to turn out. But that's it.
And can you remember what you cooked for 50 people?
Yes, I cooked a prawn and butternut squash yellow Thai curry. Ooh, with, and I made about 150 flatbreads from scratch.
Gosh.
Just knocked them up.
As you do.
Yeah.
Fabulous. So I have to ask you about your new book, The Things We Left Unsaid. Is it very different to other books that you've written, would you say?
Yes, it is. It's I think it's a much deeper emotional story, and it's about the relationship between a mother and a daughter. And I lost my mother about 5 years ago, and I think that has had a profound effect on me. And I can absolutely tell in my work now that I'm sort of working through all those strands of that relationship that I still feel need to be explored. And it's about, we all know our parents from the moment that we know them being a parent. But we don't know who that person was before we came along. Mm-hmm. And it's about how you spend so much time with your parents, but you don't necessarily get to know them.
What an interesting thought. Yes. So tell us, can you tell us a bit about the mother and the daughter in the book?
Now, I have to be careful because there's some enormous plot points, but basically, I think I can tell you that the book is split into two time frames, present day with Rachel, the daughter, and we go back to 1964. And it, on the face of it, it begins with Rachel has been jilted and she has had to go back home to live with her mother. She's just lost her father. So it's about grief as well and how you cope with that. But really, the book is about the mother's coming of age story and her journey through to the point where Rachel is born. And that's told in the past. And it's about Rachel discovering the things that she never knew about her mother in the process.
And was it quite a cathartic experience for you?
Yes, I think it was. The stuff that I have had to process with my mother is very different from the one that Rachel has to process with Eleanor. But in my own personal experience, my mother very clearly had an undiagnosed mental illness, which took me about 35 years to fully understand that it wasn't that she was awful, she was just unwell. Mm-hmm. And I think that's, again, I think that generation, their questions about mental health for our parents, I mean, I'm 52 now, so people who would be in their 70s and up, it just was not discussed. And my mother had a postpartum psychosis after I was born. And that was never, ever talked about. Nobody ever helped her. It was something to be ashamed of. And that changed her forever. And what is astonishing to me now, looking back, is that nobody asked her if she needed help, which is extraordinary. And I think, and people will probably recognize this, if you are brought up or you live with somebody who is emotionally volatile and has no control over how they react to things, what happens is, it's a bit like Stockholm syndrome, is that your default position is just don't upset them, don't set an episode off. And so you end up never challenging people, and you end up just wanting to keep the peace. And the net effect of that is that that person never gets any help. That person doesn't get the help that they might need. And I think the greatest sadness I have about my mother, she was like the nursery rhyme. When she was good, she was very, very good. But when she was bad, she was horrid. And she was the most wonderful, unique individual. She was the funniest person I have ever known in my life. And when she was happy, when she was in a stable frame of mind, she was honestly the greatest company you could ever want to be around. But when she was having a dark episode, it was horrendous, absolutely horrific. And what I think is so sad for me is that I will never know if she could have had her life vastly improved with medicine.
Wow. It's sad, isn't it? I think, you know, as you say, it's a generational thing, because now you'd hope and assume that it's noticed more when people have issues and people are hopefully sort of automatically helped or at least offered help more readily.
Yes. Well, I would like to think that, the conversation about mental health is much more open now. But I think for that generation, I imagine there are a lot, thousands of people who have suffered, like my mother suffered, you know, she suffered, and it's just a great, great shame that they have spent pretty much the vast majority of their life in terrible pain.
Mm. Well, we thank you very much for coming on and talking a bit about it and writing this book. It's called The Things We Left Unsaid, and it's available to buy on our website in the TRE bookshop section. It's by Emma Kennedy, who we've been chatting to. Emma, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
The TRE Book Show is sponsored by Audible. Click on the Audible banner on the talkradioeurope.com homepage to download your free audiobook today. Terms and conditions apply.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line now from the UK is Robert Lyons to talk about his debut novel, The Shell Collector. He's done extensive research and used his own knowledge of the City of London during the period in which the novel is set, which produce a definite air of authority. Welcome to the Book Show, Robert.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for joining us. And congratulations, your debut novel. Very exciting.
It is, isn't it? It's been a long time in the waiting, but finally I've made it.
Fantastic. Have you been working on it a while then?
Well, yeah, a very long time, but in spasms, I should call it. Mostly I've sort of left it to one side, but I started writing it 25 years ago. I completed a first draft, which I thought was not very good. And then I left it for about 10 or 12 years, had a look at it again. I'm a businessman, so I don't have, you know, a lot of spare time for writing. But when I came back to it, I thought I did a little bit better. But then things happened, and I set it aside again. And finally, last year, I showed it to somebody, an American novelist, who was having dinner with us, and she said to me, "Well, come on, you've got to get on with it. It's you must finish it, and you must publish it," which is how I did.
Yes, fantastic. And when is it set then?
In the early 70s. It's around the crash of 1973-4. The share index reached a peak of 540-odd in May 1972, and by January 1975, it was down to 146, a drop of 73%. So it was a real roller coaster time for people who were operating in the stock markets.
Mm. Oh, and was that you at the time?
No, that was not me at all. I was.
Ah.
I knew nothing about what was going on here until many years later. No, I was a retailer. I helped run department stores, so I was a very different kind of animal from this.
So, why have you set it in the City of London then, in the stock market? How have you learnt about that world?
Well, because I found the story. My own experience was when our group was taken over. My own city experience. I had 2 or 3 months of our group being taken over. That was not a very good time for us. Then I sort of worked for myself ever since then. And all of a sudden, in the early 90s, I asked about a friend of mine who was somebody I'd known socially around this time. And I was told he'd been involved in a financial affair that had led to a public investigation. So shortly after this, I met somebody who'd been close to him, and I asked where I could find a copy of the report of the investigation. He said he didn't have one, and there was nothing in it worth reading anyway, and no one had been criticized. I didn't really trust him, so I began to look for a copy. And when I found one, it was obvious why he hadn't wanted me to read it. It was a great read, and in places very funny. And I'd always wanted to write a novel, and I thought this was the story I'd try to tell. Not as fact, but as fiction. What I didn't know, I would make up.
Mm.
And that's where I started.
Interesting. So what more did you find out with this story?
What did I find out? I found out an awful lot. It taught me a lot about what went on in the city. I just loved the story that I'd read in the report. and I thought it was worth telling to others.
Mm. So what more can you tell us about the story that made you think you wanted to tell other people about it?
It was a contested takeover. Just as the fall in share prices reached a critical phase, and it tells about how the hero or villain, depending on how you see him, dealt with the prospect of financial disaster. I mean, I think it's a great story of a great place at a great time. The real question is whether I've done it justice. I just hope the readers who think of the City of London as a foreign country will find it's not as inaccessible as they thought. I just hope they'll laugh as they learn and learn as they laugh, because I think it's a terrific tale, and I just hope anyone who reads it enjoys it.
Yes. It's interesting to have a character where some people could hail him as a hero and others really dislike him, you know, and disapprove.
Well, my editor did. He first go, he didn't like him. And then when he said he read it a second time, he said he really did feel rather sympathetic towards him, which is what I've always done. I mean, he was really a hero villain, my character, and I think he's a very much a three-dimensional character.
Yes. So tell us about Guy, then, in the book.
Guy in the book, what can I say? He's a very, very bright guy, a very sharp dealer. He scares the hell out of everybody who comes across him, because he goes around, he calls it hotting them. He wants to hot other guys. He wants to prove he's sharper than them, and he is. He has a friend who is also initially a stockbroker. Guy was initially a fund manager. This other guy, Harry, is a stockbroker. And between them, they sort of plot as to how they're going to make, who's going to be the first to make £1 million. And they bet a lunch at Maxime's in Paris on the first to make the million. And really, the start and finish of the book is what happens to the bet. I think I'd better not say anything more about it, because that would give the game away.
Yes. So is the idea that they go to any means to win the bet?
To most means. They don't break the law. They don't break the law.
And do you think some people reading the book will be rooting for Harry and some for Guy?
I don't know whether they will. I just hope that they enjoy their read. The city is thought of as I think to many people, and it certainly was to me, and still is in many ways, a sort of a place where, I don't know, a few very bright guys make an awful lot of money, and nobody else quite knows how they do it.
Yes.
In this, they won't. I hope they won't care. The readers won't care too much about who wins. I hope they'll just enjoy the roller coaster ride, which I hope I've created, which sort of sets up the initial triumph, then the disaster, and finally the denouement.
And has it made you want to write more?
At present, I'm not able to write more, because I want to get this book out. I have a little bit of a family problem at present. My wife isn't well. And until she's well, I don't think I'll have time to do anything but really look after her and make sure that she gets better.
Yes, absolutely. Well, I very much hope your wife does get better, and good luck with the book. It's called The Shell Collector. It's by Robert Lyons, who we've been chatting to, and it's available to buy on our website in the TRE bookshop section. Robert, thank you very much for joining us.
And thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
The TRE Book Show is sponsored by Audible. Click on the Audible banner on the talkradioeurope.com homepage to download your free audiobook today. Terms and conditions apply.
The Book Programme. Presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line now from New Zealand is Susan Edmonds, a business journalist by day and a fiction author by night. Most of her non-work writing relates to motherhood and the crazy experience of being left to take care of a child when you have no real idea what you're doing. She's with us on the book show to talk about her latest novel. It's called Mummy Needs a Break, and it's the hilarious story of the ups and downs of unexpected single motherhood. Welcome to the book show, Susan.
Thank you.
Thanks very much for joining us. And it must be fun writing these types of books. Is it? You can really kind of have a laugh with them and with the characters and the story, I assume.
Yeah, I think so. I think, you know, when you have children, you notice all the crazy things that they do kind of all the time. And it's nice to take the opportunity sometimes to put it down in writing. And it's amazing how universal some of those experiences are, I think. Lots of my friends say, oh, my kid did that too, and it's so good to know that I'm not alone.
Yeah, absolutely. But why have you made them kind of fictional?
Probably so that my kids don't hate me when they're older. I think it's good to just step back a little bit sometimes and make it not just quite so brutally real.
Yes, fair enough. So tell us about the characters in the book.
Well, I should admit that the boy in the book is based on my son. So it's about a woman who discovers that her husband is having an affair when she's about to have her second baby. So suddenly she's left on her own and trying to muddle through, which is crazy enough, you know, anyway. But then when you have your relationship falling apart around you, you know, it's just that extra level of trouble. And she just picks herself up and eventually gets on with it again. But it's just, I guess, chaos on the next level beyond what your normal chaos with two small children which is, you know, pretty large anyway.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's important to kind of, I like the way that it's, you know, we're able to kind of laugh at the situation and what's going on with the children and the mum struggling to cope, because the reality of the situation probably isn't that funny at all.
No, that's right. And I think probably if you were living through that, you maybe wouldn't be laughing quite as often as I hope you do when you read the book. But I think that if you got too mired down in the doom and the gloom of what, you know, the bleaker parts of the story, then it probably wouldn't be as much fun to read.
Yeah. So tell us about the kids in the book.
Well, there's Thomas, who's 2.5, and he turns sort of 3 over the course of the book. And he's, you know, typical boy, and he gets into everything, and he doesn't want to eat what you want him to eat, and he just likes his one particular brand of crackers, and he just gets messy, and he doesn't want to go to daycare, and then he doesn't want to come home, and he, you know, all those things that 2-year-old boys are really good at. And then there's the baby who comes along, and they're very sweet, but you know, when they're kind of in that potato phase, I suppose, for the first couple of months, where, you know, you cuddle them and they're gorgeous, but they don't have a huge amount of personality until, I don't know, 3 months, maybe.
And what's Rachel like? Has she got much support? Obviously, with her husband leaving, but has she got support from friends and other family members?
Yeah, she's got her coffee group friends, which I think is another universal thing, that, you know, you have a baby and you suddenly have this group of mum friends that you meet up with. But she's also got her parents, and I thought that it was interesting to explore that dynamic that changes when you become a parent and then your parents are still trying to parent you with it. And I think that can be a tricky thing for some families to navigate.
Yeah, I guess anyone trying to get involved with parenting, because everybody has an opinion on things, don't they? And often people are telling you how you should be parenting your own child, what you shouldn't be doing. And as much as advice can be really helpful sometimes, there's a difference between advice and people saying, oh, you mustn't do that or you must do that. It's a bit much, can be.
Oh, it's completely overwhelming. I remember one of my friends said she was trying to get her child to sleep, and there was this list of things that she was meant to do and wasn't meant to do, and they were just contradictory and you couldn't follow them all. And it just, sometimes you just want to throw it all out the window, you know, like it doesn't help. And especially when it's your parents saying, oh, you know, when you were that age, we blah, 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 blah. But they probably don't even remember, you know, it's just completely unhelpful.
Yeah. That, again, that's another thing, isn't it? Telling you constantly when you were little, this was the situation. And sometimes, I mean,
yeah,
I guess...
You were perfect.
Yeah. Sometimes it's nice to hear that, but if you're struggling, trying to get things to work and it's not, hearing that you were the perfect baby really doesn't help.
What have I done wrong?
Yeah, exactly. So do you think there would be a sequel to this, or do you like to write standalone books?
There is another one coming, but it's not a straight sequel. It's kind of a similar situation, but focusing on one of her friends rather than directly the same character again. So it's got some of the same themes running through it, but it's a different family.
Okay. And have you written sequels
so
before?
No, actually, this book is my first ever. So this second one is my second attempt ever. So that one's coming out, I think, in early next year.
Oh, fantastic. So how did you find the first book, Glenn?
Well, I started writing it when my daughter was a baby, and I took some time off work for the first time kind of in a really long time. I didn't really know what to do with myself, which makes me sound kind of, I guess, a bit crazy, but I just kind of sat down and wrote it every time she was asleep, and it was kind of what kept me going through that crazy period of almost losing your mind with no sleep and that sort of thing. And then it kind of just became a book, and then it went from there. And it was, I didn't really set out to write what it is now, but it took shape over that first year of my daughter's life, and now it's off in the world, which is interesting.
Oh, fantastic. Mm. And are you pleased with it?
Yeah, I hope that people can enjoy it and get a laugh, and also realise that, you know, there's the problems that mothers in particular face, you know, getting lumped with kind of everything right from the beginning is something that a lot of people have to grapple with. And, you know, sometimes that kind of strength in numbers is quite reassuring, maybe.
Yeah. And the process of writing this compared to the business journalism that you do must be very, very different.
It's quite different, yes. I don't write about nappies very much in my day job. Or breastfeeding or childbirthing. But no, it is. I write for fun, and I write at night, and when I get a minute to myself, which is not very often. And then, but I suppose the process of writing words to completion is the same, whatever you're writing.
Yeah. And would you say it's easier writing fiction?
No, I don't think so, because when you're writing, you know, journalism, you know what you have to say, whereas when you're writing a novel, you kind of find it out as you go along, I think.
Yeah.
So it's more reassuring when you sit down to write a news feature and say, well, these are the points I want to get across, whereas with a novel, you kind of waffle your way along and find out what the story is, I think.
Yeah. It's funny, with a novel, you've got more freedom, but sometimes that can be more overwhelming.
Yeah, a bit paralysing.
Yeah.
That's right. No, but it was a great. I'm trying to write a third, so obviously I'm not too burnt by the experience of trying to get it here. I think it's a different genre, I guess, is a good way to exercise those same writing muscles.
Yeah, definitely. Mm. Well, if people want to get a copy of Mummy Needs a Break, it's out now and available to buy on our website in the TRE bookshop section. It's by Susan Edmonds, who we've been chatting to. Susan, thank you very much for joining us, and best of luck with the book.
Oh, thank you. Thanks very much.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
You've been listening to a TRE production. If you've enjoyed this program, there'll be another episode waiting for you next week, right here on this platform, where you can also access our extensive back catalogue of shows and interviews. For more information on our live programming, social media channels, and apps, and how to contact Talk Radio Europe, please visit tre.radio.